nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
So let me say for the record that I'm happy to be at Purdue. So I'm going to start at the very beginning. So I'm going to start out talking about Bose condensation, but after being here for the day, I realized that you guys have a lot of experts on Bose condensation, so I'm going to go over that fairly quickly. But it will actually help us think about Bose condensation and polaritons later on in the talk. So I'm going to start by summarizing the entire universe. We can divide it into two classes of particles, fermions and bosons, and I'm sure all of you are familiar with the spin characteristics and so on. But I want to focus in on the transition rates. A lot of times this isn't really the way we think about them in terms of the dynamics. Fermions have a dynamical rule that transitions are proportional to a 1 minus n final states factor, so that if n is 1, i.e. if there's already a particle there, you can't go in. And on the other hand, bosons have the opposite, just a change of sign that just comes from the commutation relations leads to a 1 plus n, and that leads to stimulated transitions, stimulated emission in lasers, and so on. And we tend to think of these as two completely different classes of particles. The particles that we normally think of as having mass falling in the fermion category, and the ones that are bosons falling in the wave or energy wave category. And yet there's a whole lot of great physics of superconductors and superfluids and so on that says we can take fermions, which have spin 1/2, couple them together in some way or other and make bosons. And so then you start to see stimulated processes of these fermion pairs. Now what this leads to, again, I'm going to talk about this in a non-equilibrium type picture, is if you think about scattering, you have, say, some process in which you have two particles coming in, scattering and going off into two other states. And this is basically just a reproduction of Boltzmann's equation for detailed balance going all the way back to the 1800s. You can write down a forward scattering rate that depends on the number of particles in each of the initial two states, and then quantum mechanically we add these final states factors, and then we've got some matrix element that we have to worry about. If we do the reverse, we just start with the particles in these states instead and run it backwards, and because of time reversal symmetry, the m squared, the matrix element, has to be the same, and so that means that we can simply equate in equilibrium the forward and the backward rate, and we get this equation here. And then, this is what Boltzmann showed, and you can just show it again for quantum mechanics with the extra factors, that the only solution to that equation is this distribution, which here the minus 1 is for bosons and the plus is for fermions. And so you get right out of this kinetic picture the Bose-Einstein equilibrium distribution. Now, one of the reasons why I go into this somewhat at length is because if you're not quite in equilibrium, this whole thing doesn't break down, right? So in equilibrium, we're used to seeing these equilibrium distributions, but you can see essentially the real physics is coming from these final states factors, from the stimulated scattering of bosons. So even if you go slightly away from true equilibrium, you still are going to have these stimulated terms that are going to lead to very dramatic physical effects. So in terms of the actual equilibrium distributions, then the Bose-Einstein distribution looks like this. It has a pole for the chemical potential when the energy is equal to the chemical potential, and that leads to the Bose condensation effect, so that if you start to increase the number of particles, you're raising the chemical potential, and at some point you have a macroscopic number in the ground state, and that's what we would then call the condensate. And so this is a typical distributions. This is now log of the number of particles as a function of energy. A Maxwell-Boltzmann at low density is just a straight line on this plot. And then as you turn up the density, you start to see this peaking in the ground state. And that's, again, just due to the peak in this equilibrium distribution, which you can think of as just you have stimulated scattering. The higher the occupation number, you have now stimulated scattering into those states. And so since the lower energy particles, the lower energy states have more particles, they're basically drawing in more particles and scattering. And so you get peaking up in the ground state. So when you get that macroscopic occupation, funny things happen. Essentially, you can say we have now a macroscopic number of particles, which could literally be a bucket of helium, which now acts like a wave. And so we now have particles in principle with mass that act as a wave and really is like a coherent state. So I have this picture of a bell here for a reason. This kind of macroscopic occupation of a single quantum state is not unusual if we think of things that are sort of traditional bosons, right? So if I think of, I'm talking to you right now using coherent bosons. I'm using a coherent phonon wave to communicate to you, or we might have coherent electromagnetic waves. What's different about Bose condensation is it's like a bell that is not ringing, and you cool it down, and it spontaneously starts to ring. And that's a sort of a good way of thinking about what happens in Bose condensation, that you have spontaneous symmetry breaking, in which the system now becomes a macroscopic coherent state just due to thermodynamics, rather than you giving it some kind of symmetry breaking, you know, hit with a hammer on your own. And so again, here we get just spontaneous symmetry breaking, where now we start to see a definite phase of the system. Okay, so that's all sort of review of Bose condensates in general. Now what I want to get you to do is sort of imagine the following system. We're going to start with photons, and the photons are good bosons. Let's see if we can dress them with an effective mass, then give them repulsive interactions, and put them in a, like a mirror box so that they have approximate number conservation. If you can do that, then you have a system that will obey the exact same equations as atomic Bose condensates, right? You have a particle with an effective mass, number conservation, and repulsive interaction so they can thermalize. The only difference is if I have leakage out of my box, suppose I have, you know, not perfect mirrors, I'm going to have a little bit of leakage of the photons going through the mirrors that will then lead to some decay. And so then I may need to have a little bit of a generation term to keep them supplied. And so in general, I'm going to have to put in terms for generation and decay. But the positive side of that is that the photons that leak out become data that I can look at. So I can monitor continuously what's going on inside of my system by looking at the photons that are leaking out. Well, this is not just fiction, right? This is what we actually are going to do. So now I'm going to take a step back and talk about what our specific system is and how we dress these photons this way. So let me start with excitons. What is an exciton? And the easiest way to think about that is think about having an excitation of a two-level system, which could be a semiconductor with a band gap, or it could be an ensemble of atoms. But let's think in the semiconductor picture here. And so we're going to excite one electron up, maybe by absorption of a photon. Then that now is free to move around. But when that happens now, you see that we have an excess of charge, of negative charge in this region. And so in general, charge will be repelled from that region. And so one of these electrons in that region there can move and be kicked over there. But that's equivalent to saying that the hole, the white, the empty state there, followed this electron, right? So since it doesn't want to have a lot of charge, the hole here will follow this electron. And so we can adopt the picture of having an electron and a hole in which we have two particles. One is an electron with negative charge and the other is a hole with positive charge. And now that becomes like a little complex, just like an electron and a proton. And so those become now a bound state with each other, which we call the exciton. And so that's one way of thinking about what an exciton is in a system. It's a quantum of excitation which can move freely through a crystal. You can see this is translationally invariant, right? So this will have the same energy whether it's sitting here or sitting over here, and so the exciton can just move through the crystal. Okay, now if we think about two of them, we can see that they're going to repel each other. So suppose I put one there and another one there. Okay, then by Pauli exclusion, they can't sit on top of each other because that would require me to have two electrons in one place. Okay, and so there's going to be a repulsion between the two. And so that's what's going to give us that repulsion ultimately of our polaritons, is that the excitons don't want to sit on the same place in a single site because of Pauli exclusion. So there's an underlying fermion Pauli exclusion that gives them this hard sphere repulsion. Yeah. Yeah, so the question was, but excitons are bosons. So it's actually interesting, again, this is true of atomic condensates as well. Excitons are composite bosons with underlying Fermi structure to them. And when we talk about the boson nature, we're talking about the center of mass wave function. Okay? So there is no rule that in these composite bosons that all the electrons are in the same state. In fact, that's impossible. They can't be in the same state. So what you have actually is a center of mass wave function for the pair, for the particle itself, and this is again true for cold atoms as well. But then the internal degrees of freedom are not doing the same thing, and as a matter of fact, they can't do the same thing because of Pauli exclusion. And so you have the fermion degrees of freedom doing their own thing, but the condensate is in the center of mass degree of freedom. What's that?
The dominant interaction between excitons is coming from the Coulomb.
Yes, so the thing that makes the exciton stable is the Coulomb attraction between the electron and the hole. Yeah, so it then becomes a stable state.
And the repulsion between them.
The repulsion is coming primarily from the Pauli exclusion. Okay, so there's also a Coulombic dipole-dipole interaction that's long range, but the hardcore repulsion is the fact that you have this Pauli exclusion that you can't sit them in the same place. Okay, so now we know what excitons are. Now we're going to take a medium with excitons in it, so that's typically a quantum well and a semiconductor, and we're going to put it between two mirrors. Now, in the actual experiments, this is one monolithic structure. So the spacers in between are just a transparent medium that's also a solid. So this whole thing is one solid state device that we make just by molecular beam epitaxy layering the different layers. So we start with making a mirror here it's called a distributed Bragg reflector, a DBR. Then we have a transparent medium, which is our spacer. We put in our exciton medium here, another transparent spacer, and then a top mirror. So it's like a big layer cake with lots of different layers. But really, to think about it, you can just think of two different modes that are going on. One is the cavity photon, which is just the one of the confined states in this mirror. And so, in general, we have a Z confinement. Okay, so this wavelength here is no longer free. It's determined by the boundary conditions of these mirrors. But on the other hand, they're free to move in the plane. And so I'm going to distinguish between the K parallel, which is in the plane, and the KZ, which is now frozen to be a specific value due to the boundary conditions of the mirrors. Now, in the same system, we also then have a exciton state, which is basically has a bunch of different terms, but to all intents and purposes, we can just think of that as a constant energy and just basically the gap energy of the semiconductor with some correction terms. So now we have a quantum system in which we've got two different resonances, but they can couple to each other because a photon can be moving along and get absorbed and turn into an exciton, and then that exciton can emit a photon, and so they can couple back and forth between each other. But what happens is, in the limit of strong coupling, this happens so fast that even while it's emitting a photon, another one is already absorbing a photon. And so you can no longer distinguish between a well-defined, either it's an exciton or a photon, it goes into a superposition of being both. And so quantum mechanically, we know how to do this really easily. It's just two coupled states with an anti-crossing. So when I turn on the coupling term, I just now get anti-crossing between these states. And now the eigenstates of the system become the lower polariton and the upper polariton. Now, a lot of people have conceptual troubles with thinking about this. And really, I would say in solid-state physics, once you've created a new eigenstate of the system, that is now a good particle, and we call these quasi-particles. It's just another good particle, and so you shouldn't think of the photon and the exciton doing things separately. You've really got one eigenstate of the system, which is a superposition of exciton and polariton, so in particular, we're going to focus in on this lower polariton, and we can fit an effective mass to that. And this is really one of the reasons for doing this. So you could say, why, you know, go to all this trouble to make these polaritons? The bottom line is that we get an extremely light effective mass. So this effective mass, if we just fit a parabola to this, we can get an effective mass. And we get about 10 to the minus 4 electron masses. So that's really, really light. You know, if you think about an electron is, one over 1800 of a proton. And there's typically, 100 proton masses in an atom. And so this is a really, really light object. So that means I have really long wavelengths. And so that means we're going to enter into the quantum regime really rapidly.
What are the units of K parallel?
So K parallel is the motion in the plane. So this is a two-dimensional planar system. So they can move in the plane. And so we basically have given them a mass by freezing out that third dimension and making that have an energy minimum. And so now they're restricted to moving in the two-dimensional plane.
What are the units of K parallel?
Oh, in this case, well, this is probably a cartoon. So I'll show you some real data later on. This is so typical values are inverse microns for typical momenta of these things. I'll come to that. Okay, it can range from a picosecond up to infinity, which is about 300 picoseconds. Yeah.
Yeah. There should be a dope effect.
A what?
Dope effect.
A dopant effect.
Dopant effect. So once you emit a light, a photon, and then the electron can move, right? And then there's a Doppler shifts in terms of frequency. So the probability for that electron to absorb that photon again, so it should be different. It should be lower.
Okay, so the question is about sort of electrons emitting photons and the Doppler effect and so on. Right. What I want to emphasize is that once we take our entire Hamiltonian and diagonalize it, the polaritons are now the proper eigenstates. So you shouldn't think of the electrons doing one thing and the photons doing another thing. They're really all rolled into the eigenstates of the system already. Okay, so essentially that's the strong coupling limit. Okay, weak coupling would be to say that I've got, you know, one set of states for the electron in the holes and another state for the photons and I keep them separate. Once I turn on strong coupling, the eigenstates of the system are now a mixture of all of those and I shouldn't think of them doing things separately. Okay. All right. So we also have these things now interacting because of the exciton part. They're going to repel each other through that exciton part, and so we have exactly what I said before. We have something with an effective mass with repulsive interactions, and because we have good mirrors, we can have them have approximate number conservation.
Interaction between polariton and polariton here is a long-range one or is a short-range one?
Sort of in the middle. It's not, so it's a basically...
Compared with the size of your condensate.
What's that?
Compared with the size of your condensate.
Yeah, the interaction is short range, okay, compared to, say, the wavelength of the particles, okay? So it's a little bit hard to visualize to say when you've got the particle with a long wavelength, i.e. at low temperature, that means that you don't know where in that volume you're going to find the polariton, okay? But what you do know is if you have another polariton, you'll never find the two of them right next to each other because they will repel each other. Okay, so even though each one of them is uncertain to within a wavelength, you know that the correlation between the two is going to be anti-correlated because they repel each other.
With the scattering length, you can characterize the repulsion as a...
Yeah, so the scattering length is of the order of the exciton Bohr radius, which is like 50 angstroms. Okay, but the wavelength is like microns. Okay, so it's a big difference here. And essentially, you could say it's an extremely cold system if you think of the wavelength as the natural unit of temperature. Right. So one of the things I just want to point out, that light mass raises TC. So if I just think about the general condition for quantum effects to be important, it would be when the distance between the particles is comparable to the wavelength of the particles. Well, the wavelength, again, comes from their temperature, essentially. And their distance is just a function of their density. So I can rearrange this and just by unit analysis get temperature as a function of density and mass. Actually, this comes within a factor of two, as unit analysis often does, of the exact solution. And what you find is that the mass is on the bottom, which means now that light mass corresponds to high TC. So the experiments I'm going to talk about were done around 10 or 20 Kelvin. But there's lots of experiments already doing similar things at room temperature. And so room temperature condensates are already a thing. I would say the beautiful results I'm going to show you have not been done at room temperature, but some of it has been done at room temperature already. All right, so the last thing we need, the last piece of the puzzle, is a way to manipulate or control these things. How do we confine them in traps? We want to be able to hold them, move them around, and so on. So there's two general approaches. We've got two parts, right? There's an exciton part and there's a photon part. And so I can work on either side. So I can shift the exciton level using, say, strain on the crystal, using laser interaction. And I'll talk about this one here, the mean field repulsion of just having a bunch of other excitons. And I can also shift the photon level by just fiddling with the cavity, by changing the cavity width or changing the cavity Q. So we have a lot of different tools. I'll just talk about a few of these here. One of them is strain. So we've used this in a number of our experiments. You literally just bend the sample. So you just come in with a pin, you flex it, and that leads to a band gap change. And if you flex it the right way, you get an expansion of the crystal on one side of the slab, and that leads to a band gap minimum. So here is the red is theory and the blue is data. You can see they lie exactly on top of each other. This is a harmonic potential minimum just by putting strain on the crystal. And all we've done there is just drop the band gap of the semiconductor using the strain. Another way that we can control the energy of these is by having a wedge in the cavity. So this actually is given to us naturally. So the structure, as I said, is a wafer in which we have a semiconductor wafer. And just the way they grow these things, think about like a spray paint can. It's going to be thicker in the middle and thinner to the outside. So when they do these MBE samples, they're thicker in the middle and then they get thinner to the outside. And so that is going to have a huge effect on the cavity. A narrower cavity corresponds to shorter wavelength and therefore higher energy for the photons. And so you can see, here's data here in which we're mapping the upper and lower polariton. And you can see the exciton energy changes very little with the thickness of the wafer, but the photon changes very rapidly. And so at some point we have exactly this anti-crossing between the upper and the lower polariton states. Now, what I want to emphasize here is there's actually some really interesting things we can do with this. Because we have this gradient where we change the mixing of the exciton and the photon energies, first of all, you see this is an energy gradient, so that corresponds to a force. So if I put polaritons on this band here, they will flow downhill. They'll flow from one side to the other because they feel this gradient of potential energy. The other thing that happens here is that the mixture of the fraction of exciton versus photon changes. So if I'm over in this region, it's almost pure exciton. If I'm down here, it's almost pure photon. And middle, it's the resonant where it's 50-50. So down here, they're almost non-interacting because photons don't interact with each other. And here, they're very strongly interacting. So just by picking a different place on the wafer, I can tune how strongly they interact with each other. And so that turns out to be a really nice experimental feature.
How much change in the actual
Sorry?
How much change in the actual dimensions of the cavity is that corresponding?
It's about a 15% variation from the middle to the outside. So we're talking about a cavity thickness of a couple hundred nanometers, and that is changing by, you know, 10 to 15% from one side to the other. So that's, you can see the energy scale here. You know, this is about 20 millielectron, let me see, no, that's about, so let me see, 200 millielectron volts from one side to the other, compared to a band gap of about 1.5 electron volts. Okay, the last manipulation method I'm going to talk about here is one where we just take a laser and we create a bunch of excitons. Now, I talked about the excitons being mixed in with the light to make these polaritons, but there's also a range of the spectrum where it's just uncoupled excitons. So if I think about my momentum in the plane, down here is my mixing region. Near k equals zero, I have photons and excitons being mixed. But if I go to high k out here, I have basically just the pure exciton band with no mixing of the photons. And so when those are sitting there, they have this enormous effective mass as compared to the polaritons. So the excitons have a mass of the order of the electron mass. The polaritons have three orders of magnitude less. And so they are going to see the excitons essentially as these huge bowling balls or boulders that they're just going to bounce off of. And so one thing we can do is just tune an off-resonant laser to create excitons, and they're pretty much going to sit where we put them because they move very, very slowly compared to the polaritons. And so that becomes just a wall, like a building up a pile of boulders that the polaritons will bounce off of. And so here's an example of an experiment of an optical transistor that was done a few years ago, in which you create a bunch of polaritons here. And normally they flow downhill in this gradient of the cavity. But then if you come in with the second laser and create a blob of excitons here, you can stop their flow. And so they won't go down and they'll be blocked. And so you can turn on and off the flow of these polaritons just using one laser controlling the flow of the other. Okay, so now let me review some of the results. So this the system has really been studied for more than 10 years now. And so I'm going to start by just surveying some of the early results. Let me remind you that this relation that we worked out between density and temperature means that we have a phase boundary between the normal and the superfluid that goes like this. So we normally think of dropping, sitting at a fixed density and dropping temperature so that we have a TC. In these experiments with the polaritons, it's actually usually much easier to do this, to sit with a stabilized temperature and then just turn up the pump laser that's creating these things and go above the threshold till you get to a superfluid that way. So I'm going to talk about a critical density that you go above, but it's just crossing the same phase boundary in a different direction. The other thing that I just want to remind you of is in a harmonic potential, a Bose condensate implies a spatial condensation into the ground state, which is a localized state in the center of the trap. So this is data, again, from about, more than 10 years ago now, 2007, from our group. And so this is sitting at low temperature and low density. We just see a big thermal cloud sitting in a harmonic potential trap. And now as we turn up the density, we see that instead of the density giving higher pressure, which would push it out, it's like negative entropy, right? Condensates do the opposite. So as you turn up the density, it gets smaller. Even though the interactions are getting stronger. And so you see now a collapse into the ground state of the trap in this case.
Is this just GL map?
Yeah, so the experiment is just really direct. Because we have photons leaking out of the mirror, we just can take a camera and look at it and just see spatially what's going on. And we can energy resolve with a spectrometer as well.
Are these a Grotowski solution?
This is data, okay.
This is experimental
data. In this case, it fits to a trivial solution, which is just the ground state of a harmonic potential. And there is some repulsion that you have to worry about, that ground state, you know, spreads out a little bit because of the interactions of the particles. Yeah.
Sure. I think that this is a two-dimensional system or three-dimensional.
This is a two-dimensional system. And so in this case, we've made a harmonic trap in two dimensions using that strain that I was talking about.
So the wave function is
indeed
a Gaussian.
In the condensed case, yeah. It's not quite because the trap is not perfectly harmonic. Okay, so.
So it's indeed a single particle ground state.
No, it's bigger than that because of the repulsions. Right. So the repulsions are weak but non-zero, and so that will renormalize it and spread it out a little bit. It's not in the Tremas Fermi limit either, though. Okay, so sort of in the middle. Yeah. Yeah, so actually, in these experiments, we never pushed it to that high density, but actually just in the past year, some of our collaborators in Australia have reached the Thomas Fermi limit where they see a flat top behavior. So that actually has been reached more recently. So we can also just flip and look at the same data in momentum space. This is sort of a Snell's law picture of the emission. So as I said, you know, these photons leak out of the mirror, and we can just spatially image those. But we also notice there's the Snell's law generalized says that the momentum, the in-plane momentum, has to be conserved between the original polariton in the plane and whatever photon it turns out. So what that means is there's a one-to-one mapping between the angle of emission and the in-plane momentum. So if we just take a far-field picture of the angular distribution of the emission, we instantly get the momentum distribution of the particles. And so here's momentum space data from the same publication in which now, again, at low density, we see just a broad thermal cloud. And as we turn up the density, we pass that critical threshold. And you see now we have an extremely tight in momentum space and also narrow in energy. The change in momentum space is just due to, again, to that quantum kinetics argument that they will accumulate in a small region of momentum space. And the energy axis is narrow because of coherence. So you have basically line narrowing when you have coherence in the system. And so this tells us a lot of information.
So what is a typical coherent length which can be extracted from the width of the peak?
In this experiment, which is about 10 years old, it was about 10 microns. Okay, new experiments are several hundred microns. Okay, so we can make it very macroscopic now. And I'll show you some of that data in a minute. So here's another, just other ways of plotting the same data. And you see this is now occupation number versus energy. And again, you see that peak jumping up in the ground state. But actually, if you tried to fit this to a equilibrium Bose-Einstein distribution, you would not get a good fit. And that's because this was a fairly short lifetime sample with a lifetime of just about 5 picoseconds. And so it was near equilibrium, but you know, measurably not in equilibrium. And so we couldn't get a good fit. And so what we could get a good fit to, though, was doing a exactly the type of thing I talked about before, which is just writing down a Boltzmann equation and putting in all possible scattering terms. And so you see the same stimulated emission terms. So the pluses are for bosons, the minuses are fermions. And so for the bosons, since these are good bosons, we put the pluses in. And we just now can do this dynamically for a steady state in which we have now a pump in the system, we have loss terms, and then kinetic terms governed by this equation here. If we do that, so again, these are my stimulated final states factors. If we do that, we can learn a lot about the physics of what's going on. If I look at just this red curve here, this is in the calculation, so this is theory here. I've turned off everything except phonon emission, and you can see it's completely wrong in terms of what the data looks like. So phonons alone will not work for you. In the next one, in the blue curve, I turned on scattering part between the particles, but I turned off these final states factors. So it'd be unphysical, but I can do that in the calculation, right? So I can remove the final states factors. And in that case, you see you get the blue curve, which also is completely wrong, but it's much better, right? So you start to fill in these low energy states, but you don't see any peaking in the ground state. Then if you turn on the final states factor, you get something that actually fits the data. And so what you see is there's like two temperatures in the system. There's one temperature for the high energy excitons. There's a region, what's called the bottleneck region, where excitons are streaming down. And then in this energy region is the polaritons, which have their own independent temperature. And again, it's not in equilibrium with the rest of the system. And so I think I have a fit here. So again, we have sort of three different regions here. Okay, I didn't show the actual final result of that. But when you do this, you find that indeed the 1 plus n final states factors are giving you, are necessary for the fit that we get to get that peaking in the ground state. All right, well, let me jump forward to the modern day. All right, so that said, it's the kind of old data there. We now have samples with very, very high Q mirrors. So this is a really great credit to Lauren Pfeiffer's group in Princeton. To make Qs of better than 300,000, typically about 350,000. And so that pushes the lifetime up to about 300 picoseconds, which, as I said, is a really, really long time for us because collision times are typically in the order of picoseconds. So we've gone from something where the collision time is comparable to the lifetime to something where now the lifetime is 100 times longer or more than what their collision time is. And we simply did this by making the mirrors better, which there's a lot of experimental stuff that goes into that I won't go into. Okay, so having done that then, what can we do with these things? Well, I'll show you first just one cute experiment here. I talked about before about this Snell's law rule. You can also do it in reverse, right? So if you aim a laser in at a given angle, you can couple directly to a polariton with a definite momentum. So I can just create particles with a definite momentum in my system by aiming the right angle of the laser. So in this experiment here, that's what we're going to do. So here we have a wedge in the cavity. So we have effectively a potential energy gradient. We're going to come in with a laser and inject particles with a definite momentum. And so that's completely analogous to this ballistics thing that you solve in freshman physics, right? You have a particle with mass moving uphill in a potential energy gradient, and we all know what's going to happen, right? It's going to go up, turn around, and come back again, right? So if we do that with these polaritons, we indeed see that we have this parabolic motion. And it's really kind of cute because you can say this is interface-free reflection or slow reflection, or I would say it's the slowest light in the world because it actually reaches zero, right? So you fire in, the photons go in, and then they turn around and come back at you. So at some point in that arc, they had to be strictly zero. Before they came back again. What's that? It's not just photons, but neither was it in the slow light experiments either, because in both cases, what you're really doing is you're mixing it with an electronic resonance, which does really weird things to the dielectric constant. And in this case, you know, you can put this into a dielectric constant picture, and you'll get the same answer. But it is literally the light turning and hitting nothing, but just losing its steam and turning around and going back the other way. But one thing that this actually does for, though, is it gives us a direct measure of the lifetime. In this case, about 200 picoseconds. And we measure that just by looking at the decay of the intensity as a function of time. The other thing to notice here is the distances traveled. This is millimeters from the injection spot. So this is going about 2 millimeters from where we injected it. So these are really macroscopic long-range motions at this point. With the same samples then, this is an experiment done a couple of years ago in collaboration with Keith Nelson's group at MIT, we finally reached equilibrium. So this is the first equilibrium polariton condensate. And so to do this, we used a spatial light modulator to make a ring trap. So it's a hard wall here of excitons, and then inside it's a flat potential. And we're just going to look in the middle of this here. And now this is energy versus, occupation number versus energy. And these are absolute numbers. This is not scaled, right? This is the actual from photon counting, the occupation numbers. And you see we get just bang on fits to the Bose-Einstein distribution, which the equilibrium distribution is here. And so we have, and the interesting thing here is those fits, you don't have another parameter for the intensity. So this same, you have a one parameter fit to fit all of these curves, right? Because the chemical potential decides both the height of these as well as the curvature. Okay, so it's a very, very stringent constraint that you have. And in fact, we get a very definite fit to the equilibrium distribution. And then there's been some follow-up work by another group, which has seen the same thing in a different type of measurement. In this here? I think that's just because the spatial light modulator wasn't perfect. And so I think it's just so that circle is coming from a laser that's being used to generate a barrier. And that circle is just, the laser is just not perfectly homogeneous all the way around the ring. But it's a high barrier compared to the kinetic energy of the polaritons. And so in some sense, it doesn't matter how high it is, if as long as it's all high compared to what the polariton kinetic energy is. Okay, so here's an example where I'm going to put all these methods together. So here we have defocused the laser, and we're just showing a strain trap. Remember I said that we could use strain to make a harmonic potential. So we've got two things. We've got an asymmetry because of the wedge of the cavity, right, from one side to the other, and then we have a harmonic potential that we've created with strain. And now we're going to turn on a laser, and in this case we focus the laser to the side, and here's one of those exciton walls I was talking about, right, where we just focus the laser down, make a blob of excitons right there. And then the polaritons are going to be generated from some of those excitons turning into polaritons. And what we see is some of them get trapped in this little nook here, right? Because we've got an overall potential here and a wall, so they get trapped in this nook. And some of them go around the post, so to speak, and become trapped in the global minimum over here. Now what we can do is we can move the laser around, right? So we can move it to the center of the trap, all right? So now we've got, if you think about it, we've got a harmonic potential with a Gaussian post in the middle. So that makes a wine bottle or a Mexican hat potential. And so now we have a ring. And so we can look at what happens with our ring. So here is below threshold. We're just creating at that laser spot. As soon as we reach the condensate threshold, now we see it fills in. It's able to move macroscopic distances. And this is, again, about 100 microns across. And we see we've got the ring condensate going all the way around. Now, that's nice as far as it goes, but we can do better. We can say, well, what's the coherence properties of this? All right. This is just showing the energy that's really collapsed in that ring. This is sliced through the ring, where you see the energy has just collapsed from a broad thermal distribution down to almost all of them in the condensate state. You see, I'm going to jump forward here again and talk about interferometry. In this experiment, we are just imaging through a Michelson interferometer. So we have two images, one that goes up one mirror, comes back, the other that goes off another mirror, and up here it hits a reflector that flips it across one axis. So now we're going to interfere one image with its flipped side, okay? And if we do that, then we get interference things in which basically, the fringing is saying that this says that this side of the ring is coherent with that side because we're interfering a copy of itself with itself. So the whole thing is coherent all the way around the ring. Again, now about 50 or 100 microns coherence distance. Yeah?
So if this is a 2D system, you probably would not have very long coherence, right?
And yeah.
You should have thermal distortion.
Yeah, so actually, so the question is about like how, you know, if it's two-dimensional, you can't have infinite range coherence. And actually, there's an experiment by another group, Yamamoto's group, in which they made a flat distribution, and they looked at the fall-off of the G1 coherence as a function of distance, and found indeed that you have a power law that fell off. Now, that was done a few years ago with short lifetime samples, and they found that the fall-off of the power law did not agree with equilibrium. More recently, using Lauren Pfeiffer's samples, another group just did the same experiment and showed that the power law now fits perfectly the equilibrium expectation for the BKT transition. Because as you say, you can't have infinite range, but it can be really large compared to your system size. If you make a really big system, you can see that correlation, that G1 fall off over distance. And in fact, it agrees bang on now with the equilibrium prediction. So in some ways, that's an even better, I wish I had thought of it, a better evidence of equilibrium than just a fit to a Bose-Einstein distribution. Because you might say, well, maybe it's fortuitous that it fits the Bose-Einstein distribution. Okay, but we can now analyze these interference patterns and do some fun stuff. So if you were to look really carefully and count these fringes across the top here, you would see there's actually one more fringe going this way than there is if I went down this way. So there's actually a phase defect in the system. So if I did it another time, shot to shot, this time I would have one more fringe on the bottom than I do on the top. And so something funny is going on. One of the things that we can do is we can extract the phase gradient from this. So this is called a phase map. And it's fairly straightforward. What you do is you take the upper picture, you Fourier transform it, and then you'll see a peak in your Fourier transform that corresponds to the fringe spacing. And you just erase that peak and then Fourier transform back again. And now you're just left with the remaining phase gradient that's coming from the actual condensate. So if you remember, in condensates, phase gradient corresponds to current. Okay? So when we see here, when we extract the phase, we see a phase winding. In this case, let me see, it goes from dark to bright, so it's going that way. In this case, it's going the other way around. All right? So this is circular, this is counterclockwise. In some cases, we get no circulation. We now see that we have quantized circulation in our system, that there's a circulation going around. And from shot to shot, it's going one way or the other way. It's a spontaneous symmetry breaking between those two. Now, there's actually a trickier thing going on here, because this is actually a spinner condensate. There's two polarizations of light, right? There's left circular and there's right circular. And each of them couples to an exciton with the same angular momentum. There's an exciton with a left spin and an exciton with a right spin. So in a standard condensate, you have a scalar condensate, and you have a rule that as you go around a loop, you have to have a 2 pi phase winding, and that gives you your quantized vorticity. In our system, we have a spinner, and so there's actually another way to satisfy the boundary conditions, which is to have a pi phase winding, and also a pi polarization rotation. If you think about just the linear component, a pi phase rotation and a pi polarization rotation adds up to 2 pi, and so you can satisfy the boundary conditions that way. And so that's actually what's going on. What we can do, we can just measure the polarization state of this thing. And we can see, in fact, so this is basically just the raw data where we to take polarization resolved images, and it's marching on by itself here. All right. So here, what we see, this is the experimental result. And what you see is indeed the linear component, which is the straight lines, is rotating by pi, not by 2 pi. Right. So if you see over here, it's gone from linear this way to orthogonal to it on the opposite side of the ring, and then back over to the same here. So there's a pi rotation of the polarization that adds to the pi that you get from the current flow and gives you what's called a half vortex. Interestingly, there's also a circular polarization flip. So on one side of the condensate, it's spin up, and the other side is down. So this is a there's a linear component and a circular component. And so it's, again, hard to wrap your mind around that this is one state, it's a single quantum state, but as you go spatially around that quantum state, the spin is precessing up and down, and the linear component is rotating. And it's a single state, and it's given by the state that I put up above there. Okay, well, the last thing I want to talk about is now doing a ring experiment slightly differently. The experiment I showed you, it was nice in a lot of ways, but one defect of it was that the post that we're making in the middle is also generating polaritons. So it's both creating a potential barrier and it's a source. And so we'd actually like to decouple those. So here we made a ring trap by just etching away. So we took our mirror sample and we just etched away all the material so that we have now a quasi one-dimensional ring. So we just etched away all this material. And you can see now, if I take a slice in the radial direction here, I get quantized states for the confinement in this direction. So this is a quantum wire for the polaritons. So now they're going to be restricted to a one-dimensional motion in this ring. Now, our eventual goal is to make these on completely flat potential so that we can have circulation like I showed you in the previous experiment. But the initial experiments we did were with the ring on the side of this wedge. So remember, there's this potential energy gradient. So in that case, the experiment is like the following. We have a ring, constrained motion in a circle, but then we also have an effective gravity, right? We have this potential energy gradient. And so the experiment is going to be, we're going to use a short laser pulse, create them at the top of the ring, and then watch them flow out to fill the rest of this ring here. And if you think about it for a minute, you know, the previous one, remember I told you, was analogous to a ball rolling uphill, a ballistics problem, right? This one's analogous to a rigid pendulum, right? So you have gravity and constraint of motion on a circular path, right? So if we do this experiment, what we see is oscillations. So the condensate runs around, it hits the bottom, and then it sloshes back and forth, and it's sloshing at the pendulum frequency, which you get from the effective gravity that we create and the effective mass of the particles. Now, it actually, there's a lot of complicated things going on. So this is just looking at certain points on the ring and looking at that sloshing. This is now just time average polarization resolved. And what you see is that, again, here's the creation point. This is degree of circular polarization. And you can see that they're really strongly polarized left or right circular. It's a single quantum state. Okay, but parts of it have spin up and parts of it have spin down. It's a really kind of a funny thing. We can do all kinds of analysis of this. We can look at the onset of condensation, where we can see initially the energy is all in high momentum modes, and then we have a very narrow condensate state appearing at late times. This can then be modeled with a Gross-Piderewski equation, and it's a complicated Gross-Piderewski equation because you have to put a bunch of different things in. You have terms for generation and decay, the nonlinearity, of course, because they repel each other. You've got two spin states that have different interactions with each other. Aligned spins repel each other more than anti-aligned, you also have cooling in the system, so there's a net cool down going on. So this is the theory from Andrew Daly's group, and you can see that the period is right, but there's a lot more damping in the real system, and so this has led us to explore damping in Gross-Piderewski equations and how to even think about that, because Gross-Piderewski doesn't, in its normal form, have any kind of energy loss terms, and so that leads us to a number of different things theoretically to try. Okay, so I'm going to conclude with this. Polariton BEC is now being done by multiple groups around the world. It's well established, and actually a lot of the action now is in room temperature condensate. So everything I showed you was at about 10 Kelvin. And the reason is because the results are just much more beautiful at low temperature. But you can do things that give you indications of condensation at room temperature, including superfluidity. There was a recent work from a Montreal group. I think it was a Montreal-Scotland collaboration in which they saw evidence of superfluidity at room temperature. So we have lots of ways to control them, to trap them, to move them around. I only talked about a few of those. And now we have long lifetime samples, so we can do this with long-range motion and equilibrium, fill in macroscopic traps, and so forth. And now with the ring trap, we can think of all kinds of things. We can think of like circulation, spin orbit coupling in rings, and persistent current flowing around and all kinds of stuff like that. So I'll finish with a appreciation for my group here. The people who really were instrumental in this were Dave Myers and Shalvik Mukherjee really were involved in these experiments on the rings that I was talking about. And in general, you know, if you're looking for places to go for a postdoc or something, you know, Pittsburgh is a great place. All right, so I'll finish with that. Thanks. Okay, so the question was, how are they affected by DC electromagnetic field? So a magnetic field will split spin degeneracies, right? And so you can use that. The DC electric field, to first order, they don't feel any effect because they're neutral particles, electron and hole together. But you can polarize them with an electric field. And so that has been used by some people to try to increase their repulsions with each other, to make them a dipole gas by polarizing them. But one thing we can also do I didn't talk about is you can inject current directly. So we can run a DC current through this, and then we actually can see the momentum of the polaritons shift because they're being collided by the electrons. At one level, that's weird because you would say what's happening there is I'm taking an electron and hitting a photon and making the photon move. All right? But of course, it's not happening during the photon part, right? So it spends half its time as an exciton, half its time as a photon. So while it's in the exciton state, the electron bounces off of it, and then that imparts momentum then to the photon, because the photon is going back and forth. So you can see a direct effect of the current on the momentum of the polaritons. Yeah.
In the beginning, you mentioned that you can describe some of that physics with the dielectric permittivity formalism.
Yeah.
So what kind of the behavior of dielectric permittivity you get near the corresponding frequency?
Yeah, so let me make a general statement about sort of the connection to optics. So if you, basically when you have a condensate, you can describe the system by a Gross-Piderewski equation, which is basically a classical wave equation. All right, so every condensate, when it becomes a condensate, becomes like a classical wave. All right, in that picture, then you can just map that over to an optical classical wave equation and say I've got a chi-3 term, which corresponds to interactions, and so on and so forth. And so basically what it maps to then is just taking the nonlinear Schrodinger equation or Gross-Piderewski equation becomes an optical equation with a very strong chi-3 term. Okay, and then you can also have damping and other such terms if you want. Now, some people say, well, it's just a classical wave, but every condensate is, quote, just a classical wave. You know, the interesting thing is that you get spontaneous formation of coherence, so that what was incoherent when you turn up the density now becomes coherent and is now describable by one of these Gross-Piderewski equations.
Yeah, go ahead.
So basically, from what I can see, is the spatial distribution of your polariton determines whether the temperature is, how the temperature looks like. So basically, it's controlled by your pump.
The spatial distribution
of the polariton.
Well, okay, let's be careful here. So the stuff that I showed you in the last slides with the ring, okay, the spatial distribution was determined by finding the ground state of the system.
So starting from the pump, you inject sort of...
Yeah, so the pump injects it. That's a source that then ceases and it's turned off, okay? And then after that, the system is finding the ground state of the system, but the ground state of the system is evolving in time because the density is dropping, and so the potential energy from the repulsions is changing. And it's also very dynamic because it's sloshing and things like that.
So potentially you can also engineer the way you pump in your polarity. So, for example, you start directly from the bottom, or you start with some phase square,
yes.
Start with some spatial distribution. You can basically see it whatever.
Yes. So, yeah. So we can pump incoherently, or we can pump, like you say, just feeding a direct state. So we could, for instance, imprint angular momentum just with a laser beam with angular momentum. We can imprint a spin onto that thing and make it circulate if we wanted to. So yes, you can always resonantly couple directly to some polariton state and make it by hand do what you want it to do.
Chris, you got a question?
Yeah, I was wondering if you thought about using confinement-induced resonances, like maybe in a 1D geometry to control the interaction strength. Then you could probably make engineer attraction.
Well, how would that control the interaction strength? So I can think of, we can make trap states with, you know, controlling the boundaries.
Right, but as you squeeze it more, this is the Olshani work.
Mm-hmm.
You can change the effective 1D interaction.
Because it's sort of forcing them to be closer together?
I guess it's the mode structure in the transverse direction that mm-hmm. makes basically a resonance right at the threshold of the lowest transverse mode.
Yeah.
And then you get tunability if you can control the transverse side.
Yeah, so put it this way. We have pretty much total control over the potential that they feel. We can make harmonic traps, you know, wires, whatever. We can make modulated ones with lattices and things like that, because we just write that on with etching, you know, however you want that to be. And so if you can think of a potential energy profile that would do that, we can probably make it. Yeah.
Yang, you've been very patient.
Maybe just at the beginning, this is all kind of one aspect, so you're not going to read bird-like states.
Yeah, this is all in the ground state. So the ground state, of course, is metastable because they can leak out of the cavity. But on timescale short compared to that, which is 700 picoseconds, it's basically all in the ground state. It's probably like a 95% condensate, where like you're literally 95% of the particles are in the ground state and maybe 5% in excited states when it becomes a condensate.
I guess I quite have people explored highlighting the Rydberg light.
People have not explored Rydberg states in this system. They have in other excitonic systems. Yeah. It's like firing line here. You're just down the road here. Yeah. Yeah.
So now you only couple two states. If you have another state,
like another exciton state.
Another exciton. Doesn't need to be having the same frequency, but it's just nearby. So you can start to have some kind of interference effect
mm-hmm.
that may be used to effectively tune the interaction.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so people actually have done that. They put in, for instance, quantum walls with different thicknesses to make two or three different exciton levels. And then you can have three, four coupled states, in which case, you know, you basically would just think of having my photon state crossing through several exciton states and an anti-crossing at each one of those crossings.
Yeah, and so that would create a resonance.
Yeah, there's been a lot of schemes that people have tried with that. Yeah.
Why don't we...
Somebody from not from the front row.
Yes.
Yeah.
Stick around though, but you should.
Yeah.
Stick around if you want to keep talking to me.
Yeah.